On February 9th of 2004, 21-year-old UMass Amherst student Maura Murray disappeared in the White Mountains of New Hampshire in one of the most perplexing mysteries of our time.
For years, we have covered Maura's case and the tireless online community that surrounds it in great detail. We have since expanded our mission with this series, raising awareness and shining a light on the stories of other missing persons.
We now sit on the board of directors of the nonprofit organization Private Investigations for the Missing, which was founded by Bruce Maitland. Bruce's daughter, Brianna Maitland, went missing from Montgomery, Vermont on March 19th of 2004, just 6 weeks after and about 80 miles away from where Maura Murray vanished.
Private Investigations for the Missing aims to assist with investigations for underserved families whose missing loved ones have been forgotten by the media or by law enforcement. Through our growing community, we hope to shed a light on these cold cases.
Families and loved ones can reach out to us at investigationsforthemissing.org. This is Missing. Welcome back to Missing. I'm Tim, here today with Lance. Lance, how are you today?
I am doing so well, Tim. If I was doing any better, I would be James Renner. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great. And speaking of James Renner, we have him on the show as a guest today in this episode. It's been a while. Every time we have him on, he sort of brings this information about the Maura Murray case that is kind of just hard to believe a lot of times, Lance, isn't it?
Well, I mean, that's the story with Renner. That's like his MO. He'll bring this information. He's been doing it for years. He'll bring this information. We initially sort of scratch our heads and say, that's kind of a stretch, Renner. And over the course of months and sometimes over the course of years, this information proves to be, if not entirely accurate, 99.9% accurate. You know, sometimes it slips down to the 97% accurate, but James Renner in the background is hustling like a worker bee. He is making things happen and always on top of it. And if, what you read in his blog is like the tip of the iceberg.
That's right. And check out his blog at MauraMurrayMystery.com. And of course, he wrote the book True Crime Addict, How I Lost Myself in the Mysterious Disappearance of Maura Murray that came out in 2016. And Lance, he's moved on to some other cases. Obviously, he still keeps up on Maura's case pretty frequently, but he has also done some other projects. He started the Porchlight Project. He's working on this case of Lisa Pruitt, and he's got his own podcast called The Philosophy of Crime.
Indeed, James Renner is one of the hardest working people in the business. He does speak about the Lisa Pruitt murder, and he has a website, lisapruittmystery.com, and Pruitt is spelled P-R-U-E-T-T, lisapruittmystery.com, and he's tackled this unsolved murder, which happened on September 14th, 1990, and Lisa Pruitt was 16 years old at the time.
And that does seem like it's going to be his next book project, and as he talks about here in the beginning of this interview. And Lance, most of this conversation, we talk about the Maura Murray case and sort of characters at the center of some of this this latest era of the case, because at this point it kind of has to be broken down in eras. And this one would have to be sort of classified as a troll era. I just want to remind everyone, please do not harass anyone. Please do not send any threatening, harassing messages. Please be polite.
It is a troll era, but to be clear, these aren't the trolls that you can sort of laugh off like some of the trolls that are out there. These are trolls that have taken that practice to new heights, or I guess new depths. Very interesting to hear James's take on it and what it's done, what toll it's taken on his life and his work and Maura's disappearance in general and specifically.
And I think it's possible that some of this trolling does have case implications, and that's why it is important to follow through with these things, which you'll see in this conversation. Things are being followed through right now regarding this trolling, which is a very good twist in the case.
Right. And just like everything else that we have covered on the podcast in regards to her disappearance, if we're talking about a situation, a circumstance, a person, we've always said that we approach it trying to figure out a way to rule it out. So like you said, with the case implication, it'd be great to try to rule out some of these intentions.
Okay, everybody. I hope you enjoy this episode. Check out the show notes for links to Renner's work. And thank you very much for listening.
Before we get to the interview, Tim, what are you doing on June 17th, Thursday?
I'm going to be in Saratoga Springs, New York for the Saratoga True Crime Night, Lance.
Are you going to be featured along with Josh Hallmark from True Crime Bullshit and DNA specialist Toby Kirschman, the one who worked on the Golden State Killer case?
Yeah, and Dr. Christina Lane and Dr. Christopher Kunkel from the Cold Case Analysis Center at the College of St. Rose there in Albany, right near Saratoga Springs. And of course, Saratoga True Crime Club founder Marcella Hammer, our friend, is going to be hosting this event, Lance. It's going to be a blast.
It is going to be a blast. We're very excited about it because we made the decision to not attend CrimeCon this year due to COVID reasons. This will be the first time we're traveling. We can't wait to see people in person. Again, it is Thursday, June 17th, 6 p.m. to 9 p.m. There'll be dinner, snacks, drinks, great guests. And you can buy your ticket to see us all and interact with us on eventbrite.com and search for Saratoga True Crime Night or click the link in the show notes.
Okay, everybody, thanks a lot for listening. Check out our website at crawlspace-media.com and follow us on social media at MissingCSM. Welcome back to the podcast, James Renner. How are you today?
I'm great. Thanks for having me on. It seems like this is, we need to check in with each other every 6 months or so to catch up on all the weirdness.
You're right. We do always kind of feel the need to do a face-to-face because we email or text and just sort of details and updates. But right. Every 6 months or so, 4 to 6 months, it's just good to even virtually get that face-to-face, know that everybody is still alive and healthy and, kind of plugging away and doing the best they can. You, sir, look like $1 million.
Oh, come on. Come on. That's sweet of you. I've put on, I've got the COVID 20, as they're calling it. I got to get out and about and get on a good exercise routine. But thank you. I've got the cuddly dad sweater going on right now.
Very cuddly.
I'm trying to embrace it as best I can.
Well, you're going to CrimeCon next week. You're going to see some of our listeners, of your listeners, and then you're going to CrimeCon in London too, right?
Yes. I'm excited about this. Yeah. So I'm heading back to Austin and meeting some folks out there at CrimeCon Austin. And then, yeah, in September, I'll be at CrimeCon UK and hanging out with some bobbies, taking the lift. I whatever else they say over there. Get some, bangers and mash.
Some bangers and mash and some... some fish and chips, mate.
I'm looking forward to it. I want to stop by 221B Baker Street and see where my great great grandfather was solving mysteries. So I'm claiming him, by the way.
Oh, nice. Right. How come no one knows the address of Watson? Everyone knows Sherlock Holmes. What was Watson's address?
Good question.
Well, we were talking before we started this interview. You had mentioned that you were going to the UK for CrimeCon, but I feel like you're going to do maybe a bookended trip where you explore the city and the culture, and then you do CrimeCon, and then you give yourself a day or two. And the second you said that you had never been there, I've always automatically pictured you there. I've pictured you in a trench coat walking the streets, like in with a notebook and a pencil, like cataloging stuff, investigating things. It just feels like the UK and James Renner were meant to be.
Well, you know, I think many people, you know, consider me, you know, when they think of me, they think, you know, look, he's either gay or British, and I know he's married. So maybe that's it.
Oh, boy. Well, James, what has been going on in your life and your career as far as true crime and the Maura Murray case since we last spoke? I know that could probably fill another book or two, but...
Oh, my Lord, yes. In fact, it did fill another book. So I was working on another project that got shut down for COVID last March, March of 2020, and everybody sent home, and suddenly, you know, I had nothing to do. And, you know, I always wanted to get around to writing a book on the, and exploring in greater detail, the murder of Lisa Pruitt, who was a 16-year-old young woman who was stabbed to death behind a mansion in Shaker Heights, Ohio in 1990. And so, you know, I had thousands of pages of documents I'd never gone through. And I opened it up. And, you know, first the thing I did was go to Giant Eagle and pick up a handle of vodka after I got back home. Because, you know, honestly, I don't know how you guys felt, but I was not entirely sure that that wasn't the beginning of the end of the world. Like, you know, there's this virus coming. We don't know how bad it is, but hundreds of thousands of people are dying. They're shutting everything down. Everything was quiet. And I was not going to go out sober. So, you know, my daily routine would be, you know, mixing a drink and then going through these documents. And I quickly uncovered, you know, this Lisa Pruitt book. I think the most important thing I've ever written, because I think it's going to solve. My hope is that it solves a number of cases. I think going through these documents, I uncovered a serial killer that was operating in Cleveland in the late 80s and 90s that nobody knew about. And so I'm hoping to prove that. And at the same time, get a guy out of prison who's been sitting there for a couple of these murders that this other person committed. So it's a crazy story. It's also about how a bunch of high school kids hijacked a homicide investigation and went after the weird kid in school, pointing the finger at him, and there was no evidence linking him to the crime at all. But he wore dark clothes and played D&D. You know, it's kind of modern day Crucible too. So yeah, that's been the majority of what I've been working on. And I just submitted the final draft to my agent. We're going to go out, you know, to editors and publishers here soon. Tentatively titled Little Crazy Children, which is from a line from The Crucible that goes something like, "We are as we always were in Salem, but now the little crazy children are jangling the keys of the kingdom." So, and the kids involved with Shaker Heights and what happened there went on and became very prominent people, lawyers. One's a writer at the New Yorker right now. So it'll be a wild book. So I'm looking forward to that. The other project I had was developing a TV show for Fox based on an article I wrote about genetic genealogy. And it's the first time I've developed a show that made it all the way to pilot. And they shot the pilot in New Orleans in January, starring Melissa Leo and Tate Donovan. And I got to meet them all a while back. And, you know, they, long story short, Fox passed on it. So now we're back to square one. But that happens all the time. You know, when you're, you know, I'm just lucky enough that they keep hiring me to develop these stories, even if they're never... if they never make it to air, you know, the probability of getting a show on the air is just astronomically stupid. You know, they'll pay for, you know, let's say 100 shows to be developed, and they'll send like five to shoot a pilot, and two out of those five will make it on air. So that's, those are the odds you're dealing with.
Whoa, wait. You're telling me that you can't do 12 episodes of a podcast and then immediately have a TV show based on that podcast hit the air in an NBC affiliate network? That's not something that happens every single time out of the gate.
Apparently not. Apparently not.
Weird. Okay, so exciting stuff. Fox obviously has no taste if they passed on your pilot. So Crawl Space Media, our television division will happily take a look at that pilot and provide you with a handsome budget for a five-season deal.
Let's do this. Have your people talk to my people. We'll work this out.
They're doing it right now. I just sent them a text message while in mid-sentence. But the Lisa Pruitt murder, this Lisa Pruitt mystery, you can get more info on this at your website, lisapruittmystery.com. That's your website where you have compiled all the information for the most part.
Yep.
How frustrating is this to you? This is ridiculously layered.
It is. And I think that's one of the reasons why it's remained unsolved for so long, because it's the most twisty mystery that I've ever worked on. Because you've got, in this thing, you've got people that are muddying the waters with false confessions that put them in prison. And, you know, everybody's acting crazy. The kid's taking over the investigation and pointing to the weird kid in school. Just, you know, it's I've never worked on anything quite as convoluted and twisty as this. It's like, you know, I keep thinking of that line from Knives Out where, you know, he's like, it's a donut inside a donut hole inside another donut, you know, and that's kind of what it feels like. You know, once you map it all out, it's pretty obvious what happened. So I'm looking forward to the effect it might have on these cases.
Specifically with Lisa Pruitt, when you were looking into this murder, did you realize that you've bitten off more than you can chew? Did you ever think that? And at what point?
There's a very specific moment when researching this case. And because it was such a cliche investigator moment that I didn't think ever happened outside of movies. But I had just kind of figured out that there's a guy sitting in prison who shouldn't be there. And I mailed him a letter. And a couple days later, I get a phone call. And it's not from him. It's from a detective that worked the case. And he's like, I hear you're looking into the Porter's murders, the murders of Philip and Dorothy Porter. I think you should just leave it alone. And I'm like, excuse me? Like, who is this? And he introduced himself as Detective Doyle. The guy that worked the case and got this guy to confess, which I think is a false confession. And I think he has the same concern at this point. And he said, he's like, you know, I don't mind you looking into unsolved mysteries, but this one's solved and you should leave it alone. And he's like, are you the James Renner that lives in Wadsworth? Or are you the James Renner that lives in Akron? And I'm like, that kind of sounds like a threat. He's like, no, no threat, man. You know, I just want to know who I'm dealing with. And so that was like, I'm like, oh my God, what did I step in? And sure enough, like there's just, you know, the detective in that case is trying to get this guy to confess to other murders that happened when he was like 13 and had no connection to. And every time he gives him a little tidbit, the detective puts some money on his prison account so he can have, so it can be a little more comfortable for him in there. So it's messed up.
And speaking of twisty mysteries, James Renner, you're no stranger to them, are you?
I guess so. You know, you could be talking about a number of things. But yeah, no, you want to, should we get caught up on the craziness that is the Maura Murray case?
Let's do it.
Oh my Lord. Well, you know, the big, to me, you know, the big thing that has come out of the last couple months is this guy who goes by the name Folk. This is somebody that's kind of in the past trolled, I think, all of us. And, you know, we've dealt with this a lot with the Maury Murray case. And for once, we have somebody who has had a crisis of conscience and has come forward and admitted to some of the stuff that they were doing behind the scenes. And I think, Have you guys talked about that? Have we talked about that fake tip that came in last fall before?
Yeah, it did come up. I think your last appearance last summer, August of 2020.
That took everything up another notch. You know, you had, it was so elaborately orchestrated. And this idea that the plan was to get me to write something on my blog that was untrue, to report on something that was untrue so that the people involved could then come back and sue me for defamation and destroy my credibility that way. So they used, luckily I didn't print the story, but they used a fake phone number. They used real names of people who were students at UMass at the time and even verified their birth dates, used their exact birth dates so that when I did my research, it would all come back as clear. They pretended to be this other person who went to UMass, this story about how they bumped into Aaron Larkin at a pizza shop and the day of the disappearance, and she was probably with Maura Murray, was the story that they were telling. And I spoke to the guy on the phone from a fake phone number out of Massachusetts that all looked legit too. So everything was kind of being verified, but I still had this, I just had a weird feeling about it that I should wait, you know, another day or two. That was enough verification that some newspapers, big legitimate newspapers, would have run that story. So, but I didn't. And I sent the information to Chuck West at the Cold Case Unit in New Hampshire. And he called that number back and spoke to the guy. And apparently when the detective got involved, it all fell apart because the guy admitted that it was all a hoax. And what West didn't know at the time was that the person that he was speaking to was actually this guy who goes by the name Folk, this online provocateur. And all I knew was that it was a hoax. And then it kind of started coming out that Folk must have been involved directly in like February, this news started coming out. And then he came forward and admitted, yes, it was me, but not just me, it was me and Aaron Larkin. And he provided text messages between or Facebook messages between him and Aaron Larkin, you know, who has presented herself in the past as an advocate for the Murray family, and ran a podcast and a blog about it. But you know, she's helping him create this elaborate ruse by sending him pictures of herself. She's wearing this UMass sweatshirt that he wants to describe as something she was wearing that day. So she was very much a participant in this hoax.
Can I interrupt you real quick with a question? These photos that you're mentioning, you've seen them.
Yeah. I've got, in fact, if you go to my website on the Maura Murray case, MauraMurrayMystery.com, there's a link where you can see all the messages back and forth, and you can see these pictures that she took of herself to give to Folk so that he could describe her accurately. And they're kind of joking around about it. She says at one point, you know, maybe this is how I take down that meaning me. So, you know, it's very, very hostile, very weird. And when all this finally broke, I decided to drive out to Massachusetts to speak to Folk directly because he lives out there. He actually lives in not far from where Maury Murray grew up, but I don't think they knew each other ever. But and he was a former attorney himself. So I came out and spoke to him, and so I could see the evidence directly. And so I could make him pull up Facebook on his phone to show me that, yes, in fact, these aren't Photoshop. These were conversations that actually happened. I think we all had a hunch that Aaron was involved in some way, and it kind of provided the proof for that. Shortly thereafter, she deleted all social media, or not deleted, but unpublished social media accounts, and then republished, put them private. And then her website now is, there's hardly anything there. She also tried to get my website shut down after I reported on it, claiming, you know, making a bogus copyright claim. So I had to deal with that. The website was down for about 2 or 3 weeks. You know, it was unsupported. So the website's back up now. But it's just been a pain, you know, annoying more than anything. But there is one good thing that's come out of the last few months is, and, you know, I know there's a couple other things to talk about with the tech stuff, but the one good thing that's come out is, so I've been speaking to Amanda Knox, you know, of the, you know, the famous case out of Italy where this young woman, her friend was murdered when she was studying abroad, and she ended up in an Italian prison for like 4 years. She now runs a podcast called Labyrinths. And she's been putting together an episode with Julie Murray on, you know, what it's like to be at the center of media attention for a big case like that and dealing with journalists. And, you know, so she interviewed Julie first, and then she interviewed me. I talked to her for about 5 hours. Long story short, she ends up bringing Julie and I together and speaking, you know, through this case and through our issues with each other. And since then, I've had direct contact, you know, a line of communication with Julie Murray, which I never thought would have been possible. So I'm now, you know, sending Julie information on the case as it comes in. And, you know, she responds and, you know, is thankful for what's been provided. And, you know, specifically, she wanted me and I believe you guys too to give her any information on any of this this trolling online stuff that everybody has seen escalate in the last couple of years.
Okay, and that's going to be a pretty interesting conversation, but I want to backtrack a little bit.
Yeah.
You brought up Amanda Knox in a very nonchalant type of manner. That's sort of big. That's sort of big news, and Amanda Knox being the bridge between you and Julie Murray, and now there's a relationship there that is a productive, respectful relationship, which is different from the past. I feel like some of the cobwebs have kind of been cleaned off, and now the reality of the situation is more present and visible. How did Amanda Knox even get into this conversation in the first place? Was it simply because of she was interested in Maura's disappearance? Can you give a little bit of history there?
Well, I think to an extent we have to thank Bill Rausch for this, because Bill Rausch has been trying his hardest to get other newspapers and other media personalities to cover me in the way that I'm this out of control journalist who must be stopped, who's ruining his reputation. Not so much the five women that are alleging everything from harassment to attempted rape, but the coverage of it. So he and Aaron started tagging Amanda Knox on a bunch of tweets last summer, you know, saying, hey, you should go after Renner. I don't think they expected her to be, apparently they didn't expect her to be as savvy and intelligent as she is and want to get the real story. You know, she's real close with John Ronson, who, you know, no matter what he covers is sympathetic to all sides. So that's kind of where she's coming from. And I reached out to her then. I'm like, hey, sorry, you're dealing with these a-holes. And she's like, yeah, you know, I appreciate you reaching out. And then she got back in touch in, I think it was January, February. And it's like, hey, I've decided to do this story. I'm going to try and be, you know, level-headed and, you know, open to all sides. And do you want to talk? And so I decided to talk to her. And, you know, we had I remember our first conversation. It was a little over an hour, I think. And she was, you know, definitely cold at the beginning of this conversation. But by the end, you know, she's saying, hey, you know, look, I had a totally different picture of you. And after speaking to you, you know, I can tell, that I was wrong about some of that, you know, and, you know, hearing from other people. So, you know, which is why I like things like CrimeCon, when you can go out and meet people in person and, you know, they've built up this idea of you based on comments that other people have made on the internet that are untrue. And, you know, once I just think if you can sit down and, you know, or even Zoom face to face with somebody, you know, I think they can tell your true intentions a lot better. And then, you know, so you've got another thing with that crazy hoax, is that it directly impacted the Maura Murray case. Folk at the same time he was doing this hoax with Aaron, was working with Aaron to draft, these motions in New Hampshire to get the police to release photographs from the crime scene that the Murrays have always wanted. And in their denial, in their motion against this anyways, Chuck West specifically cites this hoax as one of the reasons not to release these pictures, because look how crazy it is online. If we release these pictures, it's just going to feed the frenzy and hurt the case. There, you know, that's one of the reasons those pictures were not released to the family. So you've got these people that are directly impacting the case itself, which is not good.
And I just want to be clear about Larkin, that she was actually at UMass with Maura Murray at the same time. I'm only saying this for context. She's, in her own words, a teammate of Maura Murray. I mean, she was. That's obviously verifiable.
Right. And she's you know, she's gotten very close in this investigation now, where she's being called as a witness in Bill Rausch's you know, protection order hearings and appearing there, you know, sitting next to his mother. Another thing that came out of Folk's conversations and what he's been sharing with everybody is apparently there was an incident where Aaron met with Bill Rausch at a bar in DC. And while there, he was sending her, or around that same time, had been sending her lewd text messages, which is kind of his MO. These other women that have come forward complaining about him usually talk about meeting at bars. And then while they're there sitting, you know, they're usually with other people. He presents, you know, as this, you know, affable person. But at the same time, he's texting them, you know, they're a foot away from him and he's texting, hey, you know, you want to come back to my place. You want to, you know, straight out, hey, you want to type stuff. So apparently that night he was with, or around the same time, he had brought a friend of his to the bar as well. And the thing to remember, you know, that I mentioned friend, and I want to be careful not to name this person because he's not charged with anything at the moment. But this friend knew Bill Rausch from West Point, and according to the information that came out at his protection order hearing when his girlfriend sued him for stalking behavior, wanted to get away from him. This friend was involved in that too. And she alleges that he would pay her to have sex with his friend. And so this is the person he brought to the bar to meet with Aaron. She ends up calling Scott Wall, of all people, to come. And he meets them right as Bill's trying to get Aaron to head back with them, interrupts it, and, you know, takes Aaron to safety or whatever. Every step of the way, this person is inserting themselves into the case and with the people that are involved with it, with the family, with the ex-boyfriend who's facing felony charges in DC. So it's a mess. crazy stuff. And then, you know, I've got things like, you know, folks sharing me texts with Scott Wahl where he's threatening my wife.
And there was some contact, some sort of private contact between Wahl and Larkin and Sharon Rausch, Bill's mom, as you had mentioned a little bit earlier, in that she was in court with Aaron, sitting there with Aaron.
Right. I mean, so much has come out in the last few months. We haven't, I don't know if we've even talked about how Sharon was also behind some fake accounts that were trying to steer the narrative of this case, going back to like months or a year after Moore disappeared. Sharon Rausch, the mother of Moore's boyfriend, is online using fake accounts and names to kind of play with the people online that were looking into this case.
Yeah, as Peabody on Web Sleuths starting back in December of 2004. And a lot of the comments she makes do seem on the level, but there are a few that raise your eyebrows a bit and you wonder what she's where she's going with that.
Anything that jumps out at you that you can quote?
I'd have to have it in front of me, but in looking back at some of the things she said, there's an article in which Sharon Rausch says that their love continued to grow and it had taken on a special glow in January of 2004 when I last saw her, I as in Sharon.
Oh, right. When anybody says a young woman has a special glow, the immediate thing that you think of is pregnancy, you know. And maybe if people were aware that she was pregnant, which is what the lead detective in the case still thinks to this day, if she had shared that with, you know, a couple people, that might explain how quickly they were to mobilize and treat her disappearance with, you know, such, you know, because this is a young woman who disappears, there's no sign of foul play, and yet everybody treats it immediately as a crazy, you know, possible murder or what. But so that might have ratcheted up everybody's fear.
And here, Sharon Rausch on Twitter as Carlo DeWitt, she says, "Any online investigator that believes they are going to solve MM case is truly addled." I just don't understand how someone who knew Maura Murray would talk about people who earnestly devote their time to trying to help.
Yeah. Oh, one other thing that's worth mentioning here is it came out that a little background here for people that are just catching up. But so Bill Rausch was Maura Murray's boyfriend at the time of her disappearance. He's facing felony sexual abuse charges in D.C. At the moment, the next hearing is in September. It keeps getting delayed because of COVID. But one thing that happened during the time he's been charged with that is his girlfriend, you know, who he was seeing when he was married, came out and asked the court to give her a protection order because Bill was stalking her and wouldn't take no for an answer. She claims had also beat her repeatedly and would have her role play as Maura Murray so that he could choke her. Crazy stuff there too. He's still under a protection order for that case. It seems that the victim in that case has asked for an extension of the protection order because she believes Aaron Larkin violated the protection order by contacting her on his behalf, asking for this victim to return a Tiffany necklace that he gave to her as a present. So what is she doing inserting herself into this protection order case too? I want to read a little bit. You know, so this is Aaron posted a series of pictures with the victim on social media and violating her privacy and identifying her, you know, for people that could have put two and two together. And so this woman's lawyers reached out to Aaron and said, "Hey, please take these pictures down. This is just traumatizing this victim further." And here's what she wrote back and this is on my website too. This is Aaron's email to the victim's lawyer. I am sympathetic to your desire not to be involved in any discussion about Maura Murray. However, as the victim was acutely aware, by contacting Mr. Renner, she was inserting herself into Maura's case. The victim came to me because she thought she was going to disappear like Maura Murray, and she wanted somebody to cover the what was going on. And while it was your client's choice to insert herself in the case, she is hardly the only one to have suffered as a result of that decision. So I respectfully decline to remove the tweet you specified in your email. And unless and until your client finds a way to set the record straight, I will continue to defend myself when presented with questions and or accusations. Thank you. P.S. I want to be very clear that in no way did Mr. Roush request or instruct me to communicate or otherwise reach out to you. But since you contacted me, I thought I would mention that on several occasions recently, he expressed his desire for the Tiffany necklace with an elephant pendant to be returned to him. Please tell her that she can mail it directly to me at, and then she gives her address in DC. So she's belittling this victim of Roush's, taunting her with these social media posts, and then saying, "Oh yeah, and if you want, you can send that necklace to me." And this is this is somebody that presented themselves as an advocate for the Murray family, which hopefully won't happen again. You know, I think throughout this year we're going to get some sort of information. You know, Folk is still sharing stuff about Scott Wall and Aaron Larkin, but at the same time, there is this approaching trial in September. So, you know, I think things will start being made public through court filings and the hearings that'll go on with that. And then that victim in the assault that took place in 2011 can finally tell her side of the story.
And Bill Roush did tell us that Maura Murray's name is going to come up in this upcoming trial.
Oh, yeah.
Don't know how or why that would be, but that's what he told us.
Yeah. You know, going back to, you know, there's all this drama and craziness, but, you know, I think it's important to go back to the main question is what the heck happened to Maura Murray and what this has to do with any of it. You know, I think what Julie expressed to me was that she's very interested in the trolling now, and the crazy stuff that's been going on behind the scenes, because, you know, this has been going on from the very beginning, and perhaps the person that is, I guess, quote unquote, the mastermind behind the online stuff, maybe they had something to do with what happened to Maura. So Julie's open to that idea. And trying to figure out, you know, who's really been behind the crazier stuff that's happened.
And I apologize if I missed this, but you said that Julie is open to considering that concept that some people or someone who was part of the trolling might have had something to do with Maura's disappearance. Do you also feel that way? And is law enforcement aware of Julie's feelings?
I think law enforcement's definitely aware. She compiled all that data that I gave her, that you gave her, that other people gave her, and presented it to the Attorney General's office and the cold case unit. So I feel like they're actively looking into it and trying to kind of figure it all out and figure out if it's a couple people being weird or if it's one person that's kind of been making a mess of this case from the beginning and why.
What could possibly happen as a repercussion legally to somebody doing something like this?
Well, I think if they're able to identify specific instances and link it to real people, you know, I absolutely think they're at the point now that they would charge people with, I guess it would be interfering with an investigation or obstruction of justice or something. There's also been rumors of illegal wiretaps of all things in this case. Folk believes that, there's audio. Folk has heard this. The captain from True Crime Garage has heard this. There exists a recording of Chuck West talking about Maura Murray's case and the details about the case. The big question is, when he was recorded, was he aware that he was being recorded and that this recording would be released to other people, including podcasters.
Did you say you've heard it, or you've only heard people say that they've heard it?
I've only heard secondhand from both Folk and the captain from True Crime Garage, and they both received this recording from Aaron Larkin. The question is whether or not Chuck West was aware that he was being recorded. If he was not aware he was being recorded, then that's a felony in New Hampshire.
And to be clear, Chuck West was the head of the New Hampshire cold case unit, and the Maura Murray disappearance was on his, I guess, docket. I don't want to, like, it.
Yeah.
It was a case that he was investigating.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. I don't know if he was the head of the unit, but yeah, he was definitely, I think, the head of that investigation, of Maura Murray's investigation.
Oh, gotcha. Okay. Yeah. Sorry. I probably misspoke. But if he wasn't the head of the unit, I mean, you're talking about Chuck West.
And this is referenced even in Folk's filing. Aaron Larkin provides an affidavit in that case where she talks about having a source, quote unquote source, and that talks about these photographs. She quotes Chuck West verbatim in that. And I believe that quote comes directly from this audio recording. And obviously there'd be some details in there that West and the detectives and state police don't want out there, don't want shared with podcasters. Because even if they were aware it was recorded, it was a private conversation. So at this point, we're trying to get a copy of that recording to find out for sure.
Who's we?
Folk believes that he can, that he has a copy. So we're trying to get the copy from Folk.
Makes me want to scratch my head and wonder where the actual, like, intent is.
Yeah.
And what's happening there in someone's head.
So, the one, I people, when they email me, when I meet them, they still ask me what I think happened to Maura. And I still hold out hope that, even after all the stuff that we found out about her boyfriend and, the craziness around this case, I still hold out hope that she's alive and that she got away. I think it's becoming more and more unlikely, but just in the past couple months, there's been some significant sightings again that are connected again with this. Over the years, a number of these sightings came in through people that have been a part of the 12 Tribes, which is this cult throughout New England. But I think they're headquartered in Vermont or New Hampshire, kind of a hippie commune type of thing. Where when you join up, you kind of leave your identity behind and you get a new name. And these names are kind of old, like Israelite names. And if you remember way back at the beginning, there was a sighting of a woman at a church on Father's Day who kind of looked like Maura. But she said her name was Raykel, R-A-Y-K-E-L. And that strikes me as the type of name that you would adopt if you were part of this tribe. But I was sent pictures of a woman that was involved with the tribe. So a woman had gotten away from it and then sent me pictures of a woman from the group that looks, oh my God, so much like Maura Murray. And I sent that immediately to Cold Case Unit. And I even got an email back that said they were going to, track that down. So, at the very least, it's somebody involved with that cult that just keeps coming up and up again and again, she must look a lot like Maura Murray if it's not Maura herself.
And this is the same individual whose picture we sent to the super recognizer, Kelly Hearsay, right? Yeah.
Right. And how, I forgot about that. Yeah. What was the recognizer's response to it?
Her response was that she has not seen a match that close without it being the person in a long time. She was stunned. She said she had to kind of check herself and really, really look into it.
That gave me some hope when you guys told me that.
So it's in law enforcement's hands. She checks in with us occasionally to find out what the status is. Mm. And the only thing we can say is that we passed all the information on to law enforcement and you got to wait. And, She's from the UK as well, and she's, again, her reaction, she said she had to take a step back and kind of take a breath and then reapproach it.
Yeah, that's wild. Yeah, this organization, this 12 tribes, they also have, you know, different communes throughout New England and I think maybe even into Canada and, you know, just around the country in general. And they supposedly, you know, will ship people from commune to commune to keep them hidden if they wish to be.
We've covered a lot of wild stuff here today.
As some people would call it, some mind-shocking developments. This is the case that never ends. The Inspector General of the United States opened up a new investigation on Bill Rausch months ago. After Bill Rausch admitted to you guys and some other people that he, in fact, used fake Twitter accounts to harass me, an American citizen and journalist, while he was stationed with the army at Camp Lemoneer in East Africa. So the IG started this investigation and re-interviewed people. And during the course of the investigation, couple things, Bill Rausch admitted to them that he did use military hardware and software to stalk me and to harass me while he was stationed over there, which I would think gets you into a little bit of trouble with the army and the IG. So IG interviewed a lot of people. They also interviewed Aaron Larkin, who was apparently less than forthcoming about some issues there. So what we're doing now is it's just waiting. The investigator finished up his part and has given his recommendation to, I guess, the commander. And right now it's just waiting to see what will happen, whether Rausch will face any sort of repercussions for that illegal activity. But the Army's its own thing and very slow, and they're not really anxious to, I think, punish their own. But I think in light of everything else that's come out, you know, they're taking a different look at Major Rausch and maybe don't want him to represent, you know, the best the Army can offer anymore.